Welcome back to In Search Of, the podcast where, this season, we are going in search of the forgotten worlds of lost Christian women. I'm your host, Amy Frickholm, and before we begin today, I want to tell you about a special opportunity for an adventure that I will be leading this summer. Along with pastor and writer Melissa Early, I will be leading a small retreat for a few people in the High Rockies of Colorado called Discovering Your Spiritual Autobiography. Melissa and I will be leading retreatants through exercises designed to reflect on various stages of our spiritual lives. We'll identify mentors and inspired moments. We'll demarcate chapters and wonder about the future. It's a writing-intensive retreat, but participants will have time to gather as a community, get outdoors in gorgeous, historic Leadville, Colorado, and find renewal in the mountain air, I promise. For more information about this retreat, you can go to sagemountaininstitute.com. You'll find dates and prices and all of those kinds of things there. Today on In Search Of, we continue our exploration of the forgotten worlds of lost Christian women by welcoming Candida Moss. Candida Moss is a biblical scholar and professor at the University of Birmingham. She's also the author of a wonderful column in the Daily Beast. Candida has a new book that will be out in just a few weeks called God's Ghostwriters. It's about the enslaved people who were involved in the production of what we now call the New Testament. So today we're looking into the broader context of how stories about women came into Christian texts. And by illuminating enslaved people and their role in producing these texts, we really see many things for the first time. So I'm pretty excited about sharing this work with you. It is full of surprises and puts a new lens on things I thought I knew. Welcome to In Search Of, Candida. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Let's start with something that's come up quite a bit in this podcast as we've the worlds of lost women. In your new book, you explore the role of enslaved people in the process of producing what we now call the New Testament. And you describe your process as a historian involving reading into the gaps. You call it a form of history telling that is imaginative and not untrue. Talk about that. What is your process like as a historian? Why do you choose to approach your subjects in this way and specifically for this book?
Yeah, so I think once I first became aware of enslaved literate workers, I wanted to try and figure out what did they do? Who were they? What were their lives like? And I very quickly realized that our historical archive just hasn't really preserved that information in the kind of detail that I or anyone else would want. And I ran across the work of esteemed scholar Sadie Hartman. And she's not the only one. Feminist scholars have done this too. They've talked about this kind of responsible, imaginative method. And for me, what that meant was I wanted to make sure I could protect my subjects from the accusation that I was just making everything up. That, you know, this was just springing from my imagination. And so what I did was I read really widely in the history of slavery, in the history of people writing books, in histories of labor, to try and figure out, is there ever an instance where you have someone working and they're just an automaton? They're not using their own initiative. They're not being creative. They don't have agency. I read in the history of psychology. I looked at inscriptions. I sort of went all over the place. I looked at manuscripts in libraries. But what I also realized while doing this and while wanting to try and do this kind of responsible, creative history telling was that I think what we consider to be ordinary history is actually really imaginative too. So if you go look at any picture of St. Paul writing his letters, he's always sat at a desk, even though St. Paul didn't have any desks and he was dictating to other people. That's not even remotely good history. That's a projection of our modern practices into the past. And I realized there were all kinds of scholarly theories that were kind of based on modern writing habits. And so while I was trying to kind of do this imaginative work, I realized that actually this isn't some kind of lesser form of history when people want to talk about women or enslaved people who were erased from the record. They're doing something else, in a way being aware that you're trying to tell a story that's incomplete actually makes you do history better.
That's fascinating. And that's so true. Okay, can I just ask really quickly, like, so where do you picture St. Paul sitting when he does his dictation?
Right. So one of the things I was really interested in, what's he doing when he's imprisoned? How is he writing those letters? Because when you look at the archaeology of prisons, they're mostly underground. They have very small windows at the top of the prison walls. There's very little light. And unless someone had a lot of money and could bribe their way in to take dictation from Paul, which was his just general method, he's not writing by hand himself. He doesn't have any light. So he's probably dictating through a small window to someone who's outside. Or if that person comes inside, he's sort of like sat on the floor of a prison, dictating to someone who has a very small lamp, and that person leaves, and Paul doesn't even get to check what that person wrote down, because he's in prison. And so with Paul, I think we can imagine a variety of things. Maybe he sat outside sometimes, under a tree in good light. Maybe he's pacing the way I would if I was trying to dictate. Or maybe he's in a very cramped, inhospitable prison, which is the case with much of his letter writing.
That's fascinating. I'm sure that I've never thought about that before. I've never asked that question. And that is one thing I love about this book, is it just raises all these possibilities or new questions for me, things I've never asked. And even one of them, and maybe I should be embarrassed to even say this, but enslaved writers already kind of pushes at the boundary of my imagination, and maybe for others as well, because I've always thought of reading and writing as an elite skill, and that kind of leads to forms of upward mobility. And I've kind of intuited and digested the stories of enslaved people in the Americas who were prevented from reading and writing, who were prevented from literacy, and literacy was seen as kind of a potent force that they could perhaps use to develop aspects of personal freedom, and then was therefore denied to them. Or that's kind of how I've always told the story. But you're saying that literacy in the ancient world was something different. And would you just talk about that? What was it to be a literate enslaved writer in the ancient world?
Yeah, well, first off, I want to say it wasn't silly that you hadn't thought of this, because ancient people, too, if you're affluent and elite, you pride yourself on your education. And education was seen as kind of the domain of the elite man who had this great education and could think properly. But when an elite child, a boy usually, but sometimes women, went to school, he was accompanied by an enslaved person who often took notes for him. He was taught by an enslaved teacher who was teaching him how to read and write. There would have been enslaved children who were there too, who were also learning to read and write, not just because they had accompanied children, but because they were being trained to be copyists. And there might be another enslaved child sort of sweeping the schoolroom who could also like sort of grab their education while they were doing this. There are stories of famous educators in Rome, famous grammarians, who actually became grammarians because they had been accompanying someone to school who was richer than them. And the reason why people educated enslaved people is because writing is actually hard work. It is not hard work like working in the fields is. It's not agricultural slavery. But anyone who's ever taken an exam by hand remembers that if you write for a long time by hand, you kind of have to stop and like wring out your hand a little bit because it hurts. It's cramping. And ancient people feel that too. They don't want to copy whole books out. They don't even want to copy out their own letters. And so they delegate that work to others. There's also the problem of disability, and this is sort of where I started. When I needed reading glasses about 6 years ago, I was like, what would I have done in antiquity if I needed reading glasses? And the answer is I would have had an enslaved person read and write for me. And if you think of how prevalent vision loss and visual impairment is in the modern world, that's a lot of people who need enslaved workers to do their reading and writing for them. And so this is one of the reasons we don't think about it. And one of the reasons it was just so common, even more so for the first followers of Jesus, who by and large weren't that well educated. They needed help.
Right. So there's just the physical labor of writing that was probably even more considerable than our own physical labor. And then, but you also talk about forms of mental labor and forms of emotional labor that also were a part of producing these texts. Can you talk about that in the bigger picture of agency and enslavement? And I mean, people weren't just, they're not automatons, they're humans.
That's absolutely right. And I think this is really relatable to people, especially Anyone who's ever felt like they've had their ideas taken, anyone who's ever felt like they've had to suppress their feelings because of their employer or a family member will relate to these feelings. Sometimes people learn that next to the horrors of Atlantic slavery, which are particularly horrifying, particularly atrocious, that Roman slavery was fine. And the thing is, slavery is never fine. It's never okay. I have seen historians compare it to an internship at a finance company, but it's not an internship because however arduous those are today, your boss cannot beat you to death. They cannot take a pen and stab you in the eye. They cannot, you know, while you're sleeping at night, call you into the office and make you come in and deprive you of sleep to do this. And it's very hard for literate workers because enslavers have a lot of anxiety about the skills of the enslaved people around them. And that meant to be a good secretary, you have to do your job perfectly, but not so well that you might command too much attention. And people, they weren't fair. You didn't just get beaten for things that you had done wrong. Someone might have just had a bad day. They might be jealous of you. If you were an enslaved woman in this period, you were both subject to sexual violence from your enslaver and jealousy and retaliation from your enslaver's wife. And this is just a very difficult world to live in. People were constantly living on a knife's edge. They could never relax. They were constantly hypervigilant. And they had to train themselves not to express emotions, to suppress coughs and sneezes. They weren't even allowed to sort of live as human beings.
And at the same time, your work suggests that they made very specific contributions, that their relationships with their enslavers were complicated and human so that we can see some of the agency. Is that what I'm understanding of the agency of,
yeah,
of enslaved people on these texts?
Yeah. So one of the things I looked at was just the history of people assisting in reading and writing throughout history. And wherever you go, whether you're talking about clerks doing data entry in the 1960s or medieval secretaries, wherever it is you are, people are always exerting agency. They are always putting something of themselves into what they're copying. Sometimes they are improving the thing that they're working on. Sometimes they might be subtly subverting it. We're sort of familiar in the modern world of like working to task, not going above and beyond as a form of resistance. There are people doing that. There are people going above and beyond just because they took pride in their work. And it is their job to make their enslaver sound better. And so they are doing that all the time. And I think it's very hard to pin down those examples. I stumbled across a few accidentally, but we rarely have a first copy where we could see changes. So instead we have to kind of imagine what happened. Think about the fact that these texts are co-produced by an author who we might know and an enslaved person who has feelings and inner experiences and interests of their own, and also often is better educated than the freeborn Christian that they're writing for, and is thus able to make that person sound better than they would have alone.
I'm sure that there are listeners right now who are like, wait a minute, go back. Talk about Paul's relationship to enslaved writers. Mm-hmm. And so maybe we need to lay some groundwork and be like, okay, was Paul an enslaver? I mean, I'm sure there are people right now listening to this thinking, wait, I need some more background. So go ahead and lay some of this groundwork for us.
So here's just the fact. Paul used secretaries to read and write. We know this. One of them, Tercius, that just means third. That's almost certainly the name of an enslaved person or a formerly enslaved person who had been emancipated. And he refers in Galatians to the section he writes in his own hand in large letters. So we know that Paul is using secretaries. That's a common practice. And then the question is like, what's the relationship of Paul to those people? Are they doing anything? And often people have said, well, he's using secretaries, but they don't do anything. It's all Paul. And I think what we have to acknowledge there is that is the Roman elite enslaving view, that enslaved people just carry out their will. They're not important at all. So if we want to just say that, we should know that is the perspective of the enslaver. But we can also see subtle differences between Paul's letters. So in Galatians, he has all of these kind of scribal puns that don't come up in any of the other letters. So he talks about sort of being enslaved to, it's usually translated as sort of principalities of the world is a vague term, but it could refer to the alphabet, which could be a joke. The enslaved secretary is enslaved to the alphabet. They're kind of utilizing the double entendre for themselves, for their own amusement. And we have examples of people doing that in tax receipts when they're bored. And there's another place, it's very famous, he refers to Peter and Paul as the pillars of the church. Very famous phrase. Not Peter and Paul, sorry. Paul refers to Peter and James as the pillars of the church. Famous turn of phrase. And the word there, stuloi, can also refer to just a pen, as if Peter is a pen, an instrument of God, which is also how people refer to enslaved scribes as pens. And so that, again, is a sort of a little scribal pun. It only happens in Galatians, nowhere else. Is that tendency, that sort of like humorous turn of phrase that Paul actually develops and enjoys, does that come from the secretary? And I would say we have to consider that possibility because it's nowhere else.
We suddenly see the production of these texts as a relationship, as a conversation.
As
it allows us to think that way.
Yeah,
a collaboration.
That's right. And it's not about taking anything away from Paul. It's not that we don't have Paul. It's that we also have other people. And that enables us to have sort of richer, more kind of diverse interpretations of what's happening in the text. And I think for Christians, that's really useful because there are many passages in the New Testament for which the straightforward reading is really hard.
Yeah, I think I can confirm that that is true. But you're not saying that Paul owned slaves, that he was himself an enslaver.
There are some scholars who think that he may have owned slaves that were quote unquote gifted to him by wealthier members of the Jesus community. But I think what's more likely is that there are wealthy sort of converts to the Jesus movement, and they are sort of loaning. It's a very horrible phrase to use of human being, but they are loaning enslaved people to Paul and to other apostles in order to help them spread the good news. Now, it's possible that some of those enslaved workers were dedicating their time. They were volunteering it in the snatched hours they had off. They might have been volunteers, and this doesn't mean that they weren't followers of Jesus. It just means that we have to think very carefully about how we talk about their work and how we think about them. It doesn't necessarily mean that Paul's an enslaver, but he's certainly benefiting from that process.
How then did your perception of early Christianity change as you were studying it from this perspective? Like, maybe you could walk us through what it was like to begin to imagine the author of the Gospel of Mark as an enslaved translator. And just sort of, give our readers a sense, or our listeners, sorry, I always say that, give our listeners a sense of how you thought about that.
Yeah, so the reason we might focus on Mark is that our earliest traditions about Mark from the beginning of the second century tie him to Peter. And we learn in Greek, the Greek word there is interpreter, which could be a translator, like a translator, an Aramaic Greek translator, which you can imagine Peter might have needed as he strayed further afield from his hometown. Or it could mean someone writing something down in translation, an interpreter, a sort of exegete, someone putting pen to paper. And that language, when you look at the use of that term in all of our sort of extant records, it's almost always enslaved people who are doing that work, often because they were bilingual, because they had been moved from home. And so if you think about Mark, whether or not you think that Mark has strong ties to Peter, but if you think about him as an enslaved translator, how does that change how you read Mark? Well, for me, it changes how I think about the story as a whole. So even just crucifixion, the main point of the story, we always say this is a punishment for rebels and enslaved people, but that makes it sound like it's 50-50. And it's not, it's predominantly enslaved people. And the way Jesus dies in Mark is so horrendous. Mark will not let you look away from the pain. And I think that was probably very profoundly moving to Mark and to his audience, to have someone see them, to see the injustice, to see the violence. A violence to which even God responds by splitting the temple veil. You know, it is God noticing the injustice. But even if I think earlier to Jesus arrives on the scene, we have no infancy story, no backstory. He shows up. He is a claimed son of God at his baptism. And then at no point in Mark do you ever hear about Joseph. Ever. There's no Joseph. There's no father of Jesus other than God. Why does this matter? Well, this is a text written after the destruction of Jerusalem, mass enslavement of Jewish people. Many men would have been killed. Many people would have lost husbands and fathers. Many people would have been enslaved and had and been permitted no legal family. And I think for anyone who had sort of experienced that, who was part of that community, the idea of a savior who also had been kind of orphaned in this way would have been tremendously powerful. I'm not suggesting that this is necessarily a historical fact, that there was no father figure in the background. But if you just read that story about Mary, readers would think that she was either widowed, that she was enslaved, and that thus Jesus was enslaved, or that perhaps, and I know this is going to shock people, so I just want to preface it by saying, I don't think Mark is saying this, but he's allowing space for this, that she was a sex worker, which for many people in the aftermath of the Jerusalem War, for many women would have been how they survived and what they were forced into because of that moment. I'm not suggesting that Mary really was a sex worker. I think the person who wrote Mark is creating space for people who had experienced those traumas to see themselves in this story. It's sort of a little gap.
And to see a vulnerable woman, whatever our labels for that vulnerability might be, he's allowing us to see a woman who isn't attached to a structure of power.
That's right.
A way that she could claim status from.
And those vulnerable women appear again and again in the Gospel of Mark. The woman with the flow of blood. The woman who, with the jar of nard who anoints Jesus. There are no men helping them, protecting them. And yet they are making the right choices. Even though reading those stories, we have to assume they've either lost relatives or are sex workers, or are enslaved. And I think that's very powerful.
Right. It really gives you a way of reading the story of Mark. If you imagine him as a person who was himself enslaved or was very sensitive to the lives and stories of enslaved people, then that illuminates many aspects of the gospel in somewhat in a new way.
In so many ways, a story that really changed for me, and I just couldn't believe I hadn't thought about it, was the story of the healing of the paralytic. These four people, they're not actually specified as people in the Greek, bring this paralyzed man. It's very famous. You know, they pull apart the roof. They lower him down. Jesus looks at them and recognizes their faith. And then he says to the man, your sins are forgiven. Take up your bed and walk. Who are the four people that we always assume, well, they're friends. Like if you Google this.
That's the story I've always, I've always
heard
that.
I thought that too. I went to Sunday school too. We thought that they were friends and volunteers. But if you look at the practice of carrying people in ancient society, it's usually the rich. They're probably enslaved people. And that makes sense of the story in a whole new way because Jesus sees them where the story doesn't really want you to. They're not even identified as people, but Jesus sees them, sees their faith, and says to the man, take up your bed and walk. And that sounds very different, because what he's now saying is not, well, you can be carried about again as now an able-bodied rich person. He's saying, carry your bed, carry your own bed, do your own work. That is a whole different story with a very different message.
Absolutely. That is fascinating. And I think it really shows the benefit of taking this perspective and walking through stories we thought we knew. And I just really appreciate that about your book. I wonder if you could talk about, there's just this one moment that I just can't get out of my mind that's in your book. And I just want to talk about the two women who left inscriptions on an ancient roof. Can you just talk about those women? I mean, they're...
Yes. I remember when I first stumbled across this roof tile. It's a roof tile. It's from the roof of a temple from a town outside of Rome in Italy. It's from about... from the first century BCE. These two women, Amica and Deadfree, have written this inscription about their presence there, and they've put their footprints between the inscriptions. They may even have like used the same pair of shoes because the footprints are identical. And presumably they were making tiles when they did this. And the inscriptions are actually in two different languages. And this just blows apart everything that I think people thought they knew about literacy and women's literacy and who's doing what. Because they're making roof tiles, but apparently they can write at least a full sentence. And they do this, even though they're supposed to be making tiles, potentially they're going to get into trouble for this. For what? For friendship? For love? For joy? I just think that's amazing. That they risk that for this moment that we now have memorialized in this tile. And for me, I think it challenges us to rethink the questions of like, what are the social status of the people we think who are reading and writing? Are there people who aren't reading and writing generally who also can read and write? And most importantly, what about women who I learned couldn't read and write at all?
Right, and who were obviously enslaved laborers who then write their names and their and even a little bit of their stories in two different languages.
It's right. Just,
and I think I... Oh, go ahead.
If someone would do that for a roof tile, if someone would take that right. risk for a roof tile, right. do you not think that someone whose job it was to read and write and copy text would also do that?
Would also leave some mark.
Some mark of themselves.
Want to leave the mark of themselves. My church is a small Episcopal church in a small town in the mountains of Colorado. And we have one of the two pipe organs that were transported over the mountains by ox cart. And and it's still in the church and it works and everything. And my favorite part of the whole church is the little space behind the organ where the people who pumped the organ left inscriptions of themselves. They left all kinds of different inscriptions. So it made perfect sense to me when I read about these two women that this human need to leave a mark, to say something about your labor is indelible in a way. And so I felt very familiar, but now I felt like I knew these women. All they did was say their names and something, you know, sort of playful about their experience.
Yeah, and you want to know more. I want to know more. This is all Absolutely. We have for them, but they're not going to have been alone. And I think you're right. It's a human impulse. People can't help it. And a psychologist will tell you, people can't help but make bids for agency.
So how did, are there other women that came up in your exploration of these stories that who you'd like to highlight for these purposes?
Yeah. So first off, I just want to say that whole idea that women couldn't read or write, they weren't literate. Once you recognize they're enslaved workers who are doing reading and writing for people, it matters much less whether or not women themselves learn to write or to read, because they can have other people who read and wrote for them. And often, you know, when scholars talk about women's literacy, they'll say things like, okay, so we see this woman writing, but she's dictating to an enslaved person. That's not real women's literacy. But anyone who was male who needed glasses was also dictating, why is this different? It feels like pure patriarchy to me to make that argument. So enslaved workers give women access to literacy. And that's important for how we tell any story. But more specifically, we have records of women calligraphers who worked for Origen, the most prolific early Christian writer. Girls with beautiful handwriting he had dedicated to him by his patron Ambrose. And we know of other women. There's a woman named Grapte. Grapte, it's clearly an enslaved name. It clearly refers to the fact that she's a writer. That's what she does. She's a female educator and scribe who's writing. And she's referenced in a very popular early Christian text called The Shepherd of Hermas. Hermas is told to write a copy of the book and to give it to Grapte to educate women. And that moment is so powerful to me because there's a specific request that this woman be given a copy of this book for the exact purpose of educating other women. Now, historically, some scholars have said, oh, she's a widow. She must have been if she's educated. But no, with a name like that, she's an enslaved woman. And if you go look at inscriptions in Rome, as I spent much too much time doing, she's not alone. There are many enslaved women who were professional readers and scribes and copyists that we can find in the historical record if we just want to go look for them. So we can talk about other women who are writing, like Perpetua, famous martyr, who writes the first Christian diary. But we should also assume that there are many other women out there who are reading and writing and who are invisible in our sources, but who are putting something of themselves into the text. One of the most famous insertions in the New Testament is the story of the woman caught in adultery. It migrates into the text. And we could ask ourselves, while it was a very popular story, who was the person, who were the individuals who put it into the text, took it from the margins and put it in the text? And were they women? Because at the time, women were called to account for sexual transgressions in ways men were not. You can see why a female scribe might be the one to put it in the text.
To notice the role of women in the society, to notice the hypocrisies that were available, and then to put them into the text to make them visible.
Exactly.
That's fascinating. Do you get frustrated as a historian asking these questions that you can't answer? you can't say, like, I think there were female scribes bringing these stories in. How does that affect you as an historian?
I mean, it is frustrating, but for me, this insight, I've been a Bible scholar for a long time now. I'm not a spring chicken anymore. But this, for me, is the most exciting work I've ever done. I now want to go and rethink everything with collaborative authorship in mind. And that's tremendously exciting for me. I would say it's challenging, but not so much because it's frustrating because we don't know. Because I'm used to being frustrated by what I don't know. This is ancient history. But it's challenging because I'm a writer too. And I think that what work like this should call everyone to think about, especially people who are writers, to think about is the debts that they owe to other people. Is it really my book? Is it my writing? Is it my idea? And I think anyone who does any kind of work should try to think and reflect upon, what debts do I owe? Who am I responsible to? And it's challenging and maybe not entirely happy to realize that actually I too, my work is a collaborative product too, and I do my best to thank those people as I go. That's challenging, but that's important. There's an ethical takeaway for me that challenges me, but also inspires me to sort of grow as a human being.
Mm-hmm. Would you like me to refer to you in that as a biblical scholar instead of historian? Does it matter?
Oh no,
to you?
I'm definitely a historian, I'm a historian of biblical texts. Don't even worry.
Yeah, right. And I'm so sensitive to this now just because I've had such experiences working in this podcast mode with scholars, biblical scholars and historians who face certain pressures as female scholars or whatever and get read in certain ways. And so mm-hmm. I just want to make sure that if there are certain signals, certain ways that I can signal authority that I do
I think because historian has more authority than biblical scholar, but it really depends on the audience. Someone asked me the other day, are you religious? When they were asking me about what I do. And I was like, well, you know, I try really hard not to answer that question because the way that you respond to that really depends on you.
Right. So the answer and how it's read depends on, and whether that undermines then your authority or it actually enhances your authority.
Or enhances that. Right? And it really just,
can't know.
It could, any answer could do either one.
It's something that I hadn't considered when I started interviewing scholars for this project. You know, I just hadn't considered the ways that we signal the ability to tell these stories and the way that, that goes out into the world and then gets read. So I just, it's a new learning for me and something I'm really thinking about. I wanted to talk about the papyri that you wrote about in your column for the Daily Beast, about this latest release of the papyri. And I want you to say this really hard word that I don't know how to say, that refers to the collection of papyri.
Oxyrhynchus?
Oxyrhynchus. Oxyrhynchus. Okay, so I wanted to just have you talk a little bit about this recent release of papyri from the Oxyrhynchus collection. And the fact that one of them might be a selection from the Gospel of Mary. So I'm wondering what you see as a historian and a biblical scholar when you look at these new fragments, and is there anything we can learn from them? What are you learning from them?
Yeah, so the newly translated Oxyrhynchus papyri, the Christian ones at least, they are really exciting. And of course, it's always exciting. Who doesn't love a new, secret, previously concealed text? It's just so exciting. And they're just fragmentary. They're not big, but they are exciting. One of them is sort of broadly speaking about anxiety and about what you should and shouldn't worry about. And that's really relatable, I think, to a 21st century audience. That's a really relatable passage. And then there's this one fragment Jesus seems to be talking to Mary. It might be part of the Gospel of Mary. We don't really know because we don't have enough of it, but the Mary is almost certainly Mary Magdalene. It's unlikely to be Mary, the mother of Jesus, because Christians in this period, it's a second century text, aren't using Mary, the mother of Jesus, to think through ideas the way they are with Mary Magdalene. She is the key figure for thinking about women's authority, women's salvation, the relationship between gender and Christian identity. So it's almost certainly Mary Magdalene, whether or not it's part of the Gospel of Mary. And it's a fascinating text in as much as some other early Christian texts do, it's about how to, Jesus is talking to her and giving her advice about what we might broadly call salvation, but what he's specifically telling her to do is to kind of strip off the flesh and take on the form of kind of eternal, incorruptible light, depending on how you translate these kind of opaque words. And we see a similar idea in a text called the Acts of Thomas, where Jesus talks about Mary becoming male, except here it's not male exactly, it's like an androgyne. We have to get back to some kind of primordial form. And it's really interesting. It's interesting for a number of reasons. One, this idea of kind of pushing past gender norms to some kind of image of incorruptibility that isn't about the sort of confining ways that gender can restrain people. And also it's Jesus talking to Mary. It's another text making Mary a central figure in Christian tradition, showing that people are continuing to think with and about women, and that Mary Magdalene is the central figure for doing that in this period. That even in a period where we see women sort of being pushed to the sides of liturgical worship and authority positions, Mary Magdalene sort of is a key figure even for that process. As a woman myself, I don't know how much I love the overarching message of this text. You know, I think I kind of don't want to strip off my gender. I'm pretty happy with it. And I'm also aware that the androgyne, the sort of primordial non-gender, actually always ends up being male. You know, we might say in Christ there is no male or female, but somehow that ends up being, instead there's male. And so,
right. And we're all male in some way.
And we can all be male if we just try.
We just try hard enough.
Yeah, we can be virtuous, which is what they really mean. And so, like, for me, I don't know that it has a this particular text in this respect has a positive message about women and the place of women in Christianity or in early Christianity. But I think what it does draw our attention to is the fact that people are thinking about women with women. And while I don't think that this text in particular was necessarily collaboratively authored with a female scribe, I do think there are out there. And I do think that the texts that have made it into the New Testament are full of stories about women, powerful women, vulnerable women, women without whom the Jesus movement would not exist. And so while I don't, you know, personally feel heartened by the message of this text, I think these discoveries remain exciting and they continue to draw our attention to the role of women in early Christianity.
Can you talk a little bit about why we're getting these releases of this papyri in such small little bits? And just can you talk something about that?
Yeah.
So what is this?
They were dug up in the 19th century. They're from Egypt, from the Egyptian desert. And the archaeologists who found them, Grenfell and Hunt, were British. They brought them back to Britain. And at the time, the argument was, there's no one in Egypt who could possibly look after these or translate them the way we can. That argument is not persuasive to us sitting here in 2024. And so they brought all these texts to Oxford, and they started by translating the best stuff first. So like the complete text, the new text, and you can't blame them. But there are thousands of these things, and many of them are tiny, tiny little pieces with a word or a couple of letters on them. But what we're looking at now are the smaller fragments. That's why these are so small. And they're getting released bit by bit. They have to be edited. They have to be assigned by someone to be edited. And that's a lengthy process. It is frustratingly slow, especially given that there are many papyrologists who would love to work on this collection who aren't able to. But at the same time, it's sort of understandable that they move slowly because they don't want to make mistakes and because honestly, they just have so much material.
Well, that is exciting to think about what else is in there and what else we might find. So I'm appreciative, I guess, in that sense that I guess every time it comes out, a new release is made, we get a little bit more information and another little tiny piece of the puzzle.
Yes, that's right. And you know, I think people are really drawn to these kinds of discoveries because it's like a real physical thing you can hold, you know? Okay, it's actual thing. It's not just sort of a scholarly theory. But at the same time, we have lots of great texts independent of these. And there's still work. We don't need new texts to come up with new theories or to have new insights because so much of what we have previously thought was based on assumptions. And I think that in as much as I'd love to see people translate and publish all of these important texts, I'd love to see us interrogate our own assumptions more too.
That makes sense. And that is really, really important. And I think one of the really important contributions of this new book that you've given us, God's Ghostwriter. So thank you so much for being with us today and for your time and this beautiful book.
Thank you.
I hope a lot of our readers go out and buy it today and read it.
I hope so too. And if they do, I hope they let me know what they think.
Thank you so much, Candida, for your time.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for joining me for this podcast. You can email me at insearchof@christiancentury.org. Also go to our website, christiancentury.org/insearchof, to sign up for our newsletter and connect with us. Please follow this podcast and rate it on your favorite podcast app. This helps other listeners find this podcast. This has been a production of The Christian Century, a thoughtful, independent, progressive magazine for today.